This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. What's the best way to improve student performance? It's the most basic and most vexing question facing educators, and the answer keeps changing. More math, more reading, more open classrooms, more discipline, standardized tests. And yet our schools fail and our kids drop out. So now consider the case of New Dorp High School in New York City. In 2007, their dropout rate was 4 in 10. Students and staff were frustrated and demoralized. They were looking for solutions, and they went to a successful nearby private school to find them. And what they found ran contrary to popular belief. Money wasn't the answer. Writing was. New Dorp reformed the curriculum to focus on analytical writing. Writing was included in the lesson plans for almost all subjects. The theory, almost too simple to be true. Writing is thinking, and thinking is learning. Now, New Dorp's graduation rate is expected to be 80%. Peg Tyer chronicles New Dorp's turnaround in the current issue of the Atlantic Monthly, and Peg Tyer joins the show now. Welcome, Peg.
Nice to be here.
Good to have you. The program adopted at New Dorp was developed by Judith Hochman. She's the founder of the Windward Teacher Training Institute. She's got a book called Teaching Basic Writing Skills, and she joins us as well. Judith Hochman, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Peg, tell me what about the state of New Dorp High School just a few years ago.
Well, it was a dropout factory. It was the kind of school that parents took second jobs so they could send their kids to parochial school to avoid New Dorp. It was the black sheep of the borough of Staten Island. Kids really did not thrive there. It's a poor school. And they did a terrible job with teaching the children, getting them to graduation.
How did they turn it around?
Well, they had a process of inquiry that began to look at what skills the kids needed to succeed. And they began asking the teachers, what do successful students do that the students who show up every day and sit in your classrooms don't and are failing don't seem to do? And they made them get very granular about what foundational skills the kids who were failing were lacking. And what they came to again and again was that the kids who were failing did not know how to express themselves in writing. So over a process of – it wasn't overnight. Over a process of – I think it was maybe a year, year and a half, they eventually found someone who works with teachers and teaches them how to break down the complicated process of writing into simple skills that anybody could learn. And that person is Judith Hochman, who ran a school for kids who have language-based disabilities, a private school for kids who have LD. So they went to her and they said, teach us how to teach our kids. And so she did.
Well, Judith, tell us what you told them.
Well, I told them that they couldn't make assumptions about what students know, that when they come into high school, although they may have the expectations that they know how to construct a nice sentence or a cohesive paragraph, the fact is that the way they're being taught over the last several decades in most elementary schools really don't prepare them for the kind of writing that's required in high school and college and, in fact, in the workplace. That's expository writing, writing that explains or informs. So we started at the sentence level, teaching them to move from simple active sentences to more complex ones. And every step we took was supported by research. For example, if a student can produce a complex sentence, their reading comprehension will improve. And that's a strategy that has a lot of evidence behind it. If a student makes a plan or an outline, a developmentally appropriate outline in a linear fashion that projects what they're going to write, their paragraphs will be more cohesive and coherent. We did not make any kind of assumptions, and the result was that they began to see outcomes from the students very rapidly.
Those are fairly interesting findings because we hear a lot of complaints, particularly at the entry level in college, that students, they come here, they're unprepared, they don't know how to write. And you would think, well, okay, that's a problem in writing. We have to teach them how to write. What you're saying is it goes beyond that. It goes beyond teaching them to write. It actually expands their capacity to think.
No question. It expands their capacity to think. That's very well put. It also enhances their reading comprehension. We're very concerned about reading comprehension today. When kids look at what really are very classic pieces of literature or original documents or high-level textbooks, we're seeing more and more that kids are having trouble deriving meaning from what they're reading. And this isn't just linked to the fact that they don't read much. It's what they're reading. And although kids may be writing more today, they're not writing better. So our job at New Dorp, and the one that Peg described so elegantly, was to really put the fundamentals in place, and not just for the students. They were put in place for the teachers. The teachers were provided with a structure that they really didn't learn in graduate school.
Mm. Well, Peg and Judith, I should say, it sounds to me like you have a several monks there scribing in their books, practicing writing. What's going on in that studio? Are you doing writing experiments there? I'm listening
no.
to you. Well, Peg, let me ask you about an object lesson, because you write about a student, Monica DiBella, who I think illustrates the point. Here's a good student in the sense that she's showing up. She's not a dropout candidate in every other sense. She seems like a smart student. She just can't make a sentence. Tell us about the trajectory, sort of what you found, how she got started out in that school, and how writing changed the education process for her.
Monica was an example of many, many kids I met there. And I have to tell you, these are not promising kids. These are not kids who you're going to give 2 or 3 years of instruction and they're off to Harvard. Okay? Their lives are hanging in the balance because they need to graduate from high school so they can find jobs and keep themselves out of social services and out of dire poverty. Okay? So high school for them, high school graduation for them is very, very important. And it's a difficult goal for them because they come into high school very far behind the eight ball. They aren't at anywhere near grade level in reading. They don't really know how to write. They don't really know how to speak that well. These are kids. So I met Monica, and I met many kids in her class. And honestly, it's hard to see where that learning is going to take place. You think, okay, this kid doesn't have a whole lot on the ball. And then when you see what they're able to do, once they're given the tools of language, you realize these are not kids who are not unintelligent. They have sort of locked-in syndrome. They just don't have the tools to express themselves and express themselves clearly and thoughtfully. And there actually is a lot going on inside their heads, but they just don't have a way to reflect that thinking. Not feeling,
right.
Thinking.
So, and you use the example, she was given an assignment, write an essay, you know, who was Alexander the Great? And it was a simple sentence saying, I think he was the best military commander in the world or something.
Yeah, and you know, a paragraph is three unrelated sentences. And one of them is just, and she would laugh and she'd say, yeah, when I had to do a paragraph, I would just do a nonsense sentence because I didn't really know how to do a paragraph and I knew I had to fill the space. Okay, you want to slap your hand against your forehead and go like, ay, 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 what? Where did that come from? Like, what deficit of learning and teaching have you encountered where you thought that was acceptable behavior in writing an essay?
Right.
So when she got the skills, when someone, her teachers, actually broke down the skills of writing over her entire curriculum, let's face it, she couldn't get away from it, okay? These are not simple lessons. You have to think about things. You have to analyze things. And you have to take the time to write them. And so New Dorp made sure this happened in every classroom. And gradually, her very simple jumbled sentences became clearer and became more complex. And then her speaking changed. They taught them how to use certain turns of phrase and how to speak to one another and speak and create conversations that reflected other people's thinking and then their own, which is something very different than what had been going on.
And Judith, this really is conjunction-junction, isn't it? It's telling you how a conjunction works to take a simple sentence and make it a complex sentence so that you can express deeper and more complicated thoughts.
No question. And the power of the conjunctions are really huge because not only does it make their writing clearer, look better, but it also, as I said before, enhances their reading comprehension. And so they learn how to write better sentences. They learn how to plan good paragraphs. And importantly, they learn how to revise their work. they now know how, and they have the tools to go back and revise their work and improve it in a meaningful way, and not just at a level where they're dealing with spelling and capitalization and punctuation.
You know, this is interesting. Go ahead. Finish
your thought. No. So the thinking part of it is very obvious.
Well, I want to keep you both on the line. Judith, if you would stay with us for a little bit longer, I'd appreciate that, and we'll continue our conversation because we're talking today about improving student performance with Peg Tyer, author of The Writing Revolution, an article in this month's issue of The Atlantic. She also wrote the book The Good School, How Smart Parents Get Their Kids the Education They Deserve. And I'm talking with Judith Hochman as well, the founder of the Windward Teaching Training Institute, a consultant for the Center for Educational Leadership, and she has written a book called Teaching Basic Writing Skills. Just ahead, how policy makes its way into the classroom. On the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, it's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today we're talking about writing, specifically how analytical writing can improve student performance. Peg Tyer is with us. Her article, The Writing Revolution, is in the current issue of The Atlantic Monthly. Judith Hochman is the founder of the Windward Teaching Training Institute. And joining us now is Julie Ellison Justice. Julie is Assistant Professor of Literacy Education at UNC Chapel Hill. And Michelle Diaz is also here. She's an Assistant Professor of Psychology at Duke and Associate Director of Duke's UNC Brain Imaging and Analysis Center. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
So, Michelle, we've talked about the evidence that literacy training, learning to write, can actually make a better student overall. What's the scientific basis for this? Is there do we have any cognitive evidence of this?
Well, certainly as it relates to reading. So reading is much, much more thoroughly examined in terms of the experimental literature. But we know that reading and learning to read and learning to read well fundamentally changes the brain. There's a particular region in the kind of ventral part of the brain that's been called the visual word form area. And we know that this exists in people who are expert readers, and it doesn't exist as strongly. It doesn't respond in the same way. You know, the brain region is there, but its functional qualities are different.
So it's interesting. You can test this in reading. You really can't test the effect of writing. Why is that?
Well, I mean, you can test writing in terms of experimentally, but it's just hasn't been done as much as often. It's easier to study reading.
But what's interesting is, as Judith Hochman says, there's a correlation between writing and reading. The better you can
absolutely.
Write, then the more you can read. The other interesting thing to me is that this doesn't seem to be adaptive. In other words, learning to read and write is not the same as learning to run and run away from, you know, predators and all of the sort of instinctual things that that we're born with.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. There isn't a real evolutionary basis for reading, right? I mean, we've only been reading for so long, and certainly not long enough to have any kind of evolutionary change in our brain. But yet the brain is able to adapt to this kind of input and this kind of productive behavior.
So, Julie, what was the focus on creative writing? Tell us about the evolution of this focus on writing in the academy.
Sure. Well, so, you know, for a really long time, we've struggled with the different ways that we can teach kids to write. And what we know and what the research told us a number of years ago, several decades ago, we know that helping kids to focus on what they know, you know, write what you know, right? So helping kids focus on what they know helps them write. And so we built in our elementary schools, we built a really strong program of getting kids writing narratives, writing memoirs, writing, you know, from their personal experience. And the article cited some of those researchers, and we got to the point where our kids were getting to be much better writers. And like Judith said, and our kids write a lot, right? So we did that. No Child Left Behind came along, and what No Child Left Behind did for us is it put such a focus on reading and it put such a heavy focus on testing that teachers in schools and school districts and everyone sort of panicked, right? Everyone sort of panicked and recoiled and cut everything out and put reading in all the extra spaces where everything was, because we have to do all of this important reading work. So we did that, and there are a lot of places where we don't do as much focus on writing as much as we should. And then what ends up happening at the high school level is then you get kids who used to come to the high school, maybe they weren't yet great analytical writers, but they had some pretty good writing skills. And now what we have is kids getting to high school that maybe aren't even good writers to start with. And so we obviously have some struggles to work through there. We've realized this. We've realized this in our reading instruction that our kids are reading a whole lot of narratives and they need to be reading more nonfiction. And we've realized this in writing as well. So Common Core has come around now. And Common Core, the Common Core standards does the work that we've been realizing in the last few years, which is comes and swings the pendulum back a little bit and says we have to focus on this writing. We have to focus on this nonfiction reading and expository writing. We have to give these kids the skills that they need in terms of their nonfiction writing.
And the other thing that seems to me, and you can tell me if this is true, but what might have been lost in the emphasis on narrative writing, even before it was dropped, was less emphasis on the technique, the technical parts of writing. So it's more important that you express yourself and get yourself out there than how well the sentence or the paragraph was constructed.
I think that wasn't the intention, but that is certainly in some instances the way things played out, yeah.
So Judith Hochman, let me talk about this because the education community had begun to criticize this whole emphasis on diagramming sentences and parts of speech. I know when my kids were going to school in the 80s, they didn't learn, they'd never heard the word noun or verb, not once in 6 years or in 12 years. Did you have trouble bringing this back? Was it a hard sell when you said we're going to learn what a conjunction is and what it does?
Well, let me clarify something. Grammar, when taught in isolation, does not improve mm-hmm. writing.
Right.
So all of the sentence diagramming and other grammar exercises that linguistically gifted kids love doing does nothing to improve writing. And I think that that's pretty much been supported, and I'm sure you would both agree, mm-hmm. by the research at this point. Grammar, to be taught effectively, has to be embedded and should be embedded in content. And that can be done in elementary school using a variety of strategies. The most researched one is sentence combining. Mm-hmm. So say if they're studying the Plains Indians and there's four or five short, simple, active sentences that they have to combine to make a more complex one, they can, in the act of doing that, learn to use parts of speech very effectively to make a more complex sentence. And that's just one example.
Well, let me stop you there. I'd like to get it. Maybe you can even spell that out for us, because you're going to give us those simple sentences that are actually facts about the so it's content. I'm learning content about this group of Indians. And then you say, now I want you to use if, although, and so you give me four different conjunctions, and I have to recombine those four sentences four different ways using a different conjunction each time.
Well, it isn't just about conjunctions. It's about learning to use a pronoun properly. It's like inserting in a positive in the combined sentence to get the information out to the all-important reader more effectively. I mean, one of the things that happened in elementary school with the journaling and with the memoirs and with what, and I'm not saying this in a pejorative way, but self-centered writing, is that the focus on the audience was lost. The focus on modifying one's writing for the audience didn't get much emphasis. And writing is a fantastic way to gain more knowledge. Yeah, they know best about themselves, but a lot of the kids that we're teaching, and certainly the kids that Peg is referring to in Newdorp, they had to learn a lot more than about themselves. And that includes elementary school kids as well.
Well, Michelle Diaz, let me ask you that question, because we were talking about high school students. Is it too late at high school to essentially rewire the brain to become a better thinker using these techniques?
Absolutely not. The brain goes through a dramatic growth and also pruning back of connections that continues to occur into adolescence, even into the 20s and maybe even as late as 30. And the thing, the learning or the changing in the brain doesn't happen all at once. So one of the last regions to come online is the prefrontal cortex. This is the part of your brain that's involved in weighing alternatives, making sound decisions, inhibiting unwanted behaviors, unwanted responses. And this is the part of the brain that's really still developing in adolescence. I mean, you see these patterns of in teenagers, that they can make good decisions, but they don't always.
So you're saying that not only do I learn my lessons better if I'm a critical writer, but that I can make decisions. I'm a better decision maker.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think these exercises in learning how to be a better writer help you to evaluate claims. They help you weigh different alternatives. And that's a skill that could apply to a lot of different areas.
Peg, give me a sense of what happened at Newdorp when they're in this transition and you're following these students. Again, no background in grammar in any way. And now we're introducing it in this integrated form. How difficult? How long did it take some of these kids to pick it up?
Well, let me say one thing. Talking about when to introduce these ideas, the idea of waiting until high school has me scratching my head, because when I met these kids and realized that they didn't know how to use the word although, okay, I asked the question to myself many times, what happened to these kids? Who's been teaching these kids? How can you be in ninth grade and not understand how to use the word although, to not understand how to create a complex sentence? That's educational malpractice. I mean, I felt outraged on their behalf. That would never happen to my child because I have a college education, and why is that okay for poor kids? So I just want to say on the outset that I was stunned by how little they knew and stunned by how much they were being asked to do initially by teachers before the Hockman program without having been given the basic foundational skills that they needed. So when they began to receive these foundational skills, when the teachers began backfilling in a very explicit fashion the parts of language, how to use language, how to use language to reflect complex thinking, it was very interesting to see that at first, to my eye, it seemed a little formulaic. It seemed a little it seemed that they were exercises that the kids did. And I had, because of who I am, a little natural eye rolling there. But then I realized, oh, my God, this is a tool that they can really use. And then I began to see them use that what appeared to be kind of formulaic approach to actually extend their own knowledge, to actually reflect deep thinking, the likes of which I hadn't really credited them with that ability to think deeply. And there they were using it. So I made assumptions about who they were based on what they had not been taught. What kind of injustice is that? And I'm the person doing it. I'm a reporter who's seen a million kids right. like this. If I do that, imagine what the rest of the world will do for those kids unless they get this kind of these kind of skills.
Right. You felt you went in with a little more open mind, and you were shocked at your own reaction. But let me ask you, if they were beginning to notice this, did they see the change in themselves and what was happening to them?
Without a doubt. You know, it's very funny to walk into a high school, kind of a It's a big, sprawling high school, a lot of different kinds of kids. You know, I'm telling you, they're not angels, okay? And to sit in a room and have them talk about writing and writing skills with a lot of enthusiasm, I kept saying to the principal, like, okay, where are the other kids? And they're like, no, these were our problem learners. And I'm like, yeah, right. Where are you hiding the kids who really, you know, who really hated this? And really, I think it changed the culture of the school because it gave them a bridge to knowledge and it gave them a way to succeed. And so kids like Monica, you know, I don't think anyone was measuring Monica for a cap and gown, okay? And she got the skills she needed to start to think of herself as someone who's college bound. What kind of dramatic transformation is that? Where do you get that in public schools in New York? I was astonished.
Julie, part of Peg's astonishment and shock at the inability of these students to use a word like although comes from, I believe, a theory in teaching that language is caught, not taught. And so you're going to pick it up on the streets. You'll figure out the rules of language in your use. Tell us about that theory and sort of how it maybe doesn't apply to writing.
Well, let me say that I was a middle school English teacher, and one thing I know is that when you teach kids something, they will learn it, right? And so part of the although piece and part of why can't kids use although when they're writing it, that whole piece, I think is less about what they did or didn't catch and more about what they were or weren't taught, right? So one of the things that we're thinking about and moving to a lot is this idea of disciplinary literacies. And the idea of disciplinary literacies is that there's not one way that everyone reads and writes. There's not one way of reading and writing. There are particular kinds of ways that we read and particular kinds of ways that we write in particular disciplines. So if kids aren't using the word although in their writing, it's possibly because they're not writing in disciplines that use although. So we know that reading and writing in science looks very different than reading and writing in English, looks very different than reading and writing in math. And so what we want teachers to do, and what sort of the field is moving to in this direction, is getting teachers to understand how it is that reading and writing happens in their discipline, and then to sit down and to teach kids to notice the way that reading and writing is done in their discipline. This is the way we construct an argument in science. This is the way we construct an argument when we're responding to a piece of literature. They are very, very different ways of writing. One of them uses certain argumentative structures. The other uses other kinds of argumentative structures. And then the program that Judith's talking about does a lot of that work, right? It sits kids down and it says, look at this sentence. Look at the way it works. Look at how the author constructed it. Look at the phrasing. Look at the use of conjunctions, of subordinate clauses. You know, look at the way that this works. Now try it in your own writing. And it's that work of using sort of a mentor text to say, this is a professional text or even a well-written text by a student in this discipline. Let's study it. Let's emulate it. And let's recreate it in our own writing. Because literacy is, because of both the encoding and the decoding, these are both language processes, they're brain processes. As I read disciplinary texts in my discipline, I will learn more how to write them. How often do our students read disciplinary texts in science, right? They're not. They're reading textbooks, and those are constructed entirely differently. And so what these teachers are doing is sitting them down and saying, let's look at the way this text works, and let's do it in our own writing. Let's recreate it ourselves. And I think that is one of the strongest reasons why that would work.
And Michelle, when we talk about what is caught and what is taught, oral language is far different from written language.
Right.
So we do catch something very sophisticated and wonderful, the fact that we can communicate. Kids by 2 years old are doing it. And yet that's not the same as writing. And so that's not caught.
Exactly. I mean, children acquire language without any formal instruction in terms of spoken language. But that's very different. It's very it's a lot of times more casual. It maybe has less argument structure to it. The writing is much more formalized. It requires a different set of analytical tools. And I would also argue, too, that reading comprehension is very important. But actually having to produce something, produce a written document, that takes another set of skills.
Different parts of the brain engaged in these different processes?
Different parts of the brain, but also I think just more effort, right? It's a lot easier to be a passive listener or a passive reader. It's not as active a process.
We're talking about improving education today. Peg Tyer has written The Writing Revolution in the October issue of Atlantic Monthly. My thanks to Julie Ellison, a justice, who joined us today. She's an assistant professor of literacy education at UNC Chapel Hill. And thanks to Michelle Diaz, an assistant professor of psychology at Duke and associate director of Brain Imaging Analysis Center. More on the state. Also want to thank Judith Hochman, who is the founder of the Windward Teaching and Training Institute. Thank you for being on the program. Our program does continue. We'll talk more about this on the state of things when we return. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today we're looking at whether teaching writing could help improve the overall education picture in America. Education writer Peg Tyer is with us. She has an article in the latest Atlantic Monthly. Joining us now, Terrence Holt. He's a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Geriatric Medicine and Research. He's a research assistant professor in the Department of the School of Medicine at UNC Chapel Hill, and a fiction writer. He has a collection of short stories that's called In the Valley of Kings. Terrence, welcome back. Good to have you here, Terrence.
Thanks, Frank. Good to be here.
You teach a writing workshop for medical students. Tell us about it.
Well, I've been doing this, I think, for 8 years now. When I first proposed it, I had no idea what it was going to be like. And I modeled it on what I knew, which was writing workshops. The only difference is the students were supposed to write things that were strictly autobiographical with an emphasis on their experiences in the clinic. And it's been the most rewarding teaching I've ever done. Whatever I was hoping that they would get out of it, I think they're getting.
Now, you didn't just walk into the school and say, I want to teach this. The medical school kind of thought it was a good idea, huh?
Well, the department in which I have my academic appointment, the Department of Social Medicine, is responsible for teaching the social and cultural setting of medicine. It's where we encourage the students to think about what it means to do medicine. And we have an incredibly wide-ranging array of courses, so this fit right in.
And what's the theory? Why would this help make a better doctor? Why would writing a narrative make a better doctor?
A lot of this comes from the work of a clinician at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons named Rita Sharon, who some years back went and got herself a doctorate in literature. And out of that experience, she has developed a theory that goes under the name narrative medicine. She believes that given that patients bring stories to us, most of our encounter with patients involves the unraveling of a story one way or another. It made sense to her that if clinicians could have the tools that, say, a trained literary critic would have, they could do a better job of figuring out what the story means, why it's being told, what's being left out. And beyond that, she felt that that would allow clinicians actually to connect with the patients better, to be motivated to actually do more for their patients through the kind of identification you get in working with a story.
Well, and this is categorically different than the writing we've been talking about. In fact, we did distinguish it in a sense from the kind of memoir that had been pretty popular for elementary and secondary students in the 90s, let's say. Getting them to think technically and critically about writing was different. And yet, it does seem to me that you're bringing people who should be accomplished in writing now. They're in med school. They should, to some extent, they ought to be able to make an argument. But there's some part of them that had been missing, some ability to empathize that could be improved by writing their own story. Is that the theory?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, my students all strike me as being really wonderful people from the get-go. We have a good admissions department at Carolina. But this has been a problem that clinicians have felt about the profession for some time. Many of us feel alienated from our vocation, the pressures of the clock, you know, all the many things you have on your mind tend to get between you and your patient. And for Rita Sharon, this thinking in literary terms seemed to be one way of getting past that.
Peg Tyre, let me ask you, we're talking about this different kind of writing now, not asking students to write about themselves, but actually make complex arguments. In the end, was there, I mean, I don't know if you measured this or anybody took a look, but I wonder if their narrative writing, if their sense of themselves and their ability to express things about themselves was also improved as a result of learning the nuts and bolts of putting a sentence together.
People have been trying to find things to measure about this. It's difficult because it's hard to come up with numbers to measure things you can't define. And so we're still pretty much in the realm of the humanities where the things that are really important that you don't know how to quantify belong.
Well, Peg Dyer, what did you find at New Dorp?
Well, you have to appreciate that we're not talking about affluent children or, brilliant young doctors. We're talking about kids who have probably two paths. They're either going to go and get an associate's degree at a nearby college or they're going to have a job that at the end of the day, a body part hurts. Okay? So the stakes for them are enormously high. And I think that their process of self-realization, of empathy, are things that it's unclear to me. It seems to me that was variable. These are young teenagers. You know, they're freshmen in high school. So that's a very sort of protean time and malleable time. So it's hard for me to gauge like what their level of empathy was for themselves and for each other. But what was at stake for them in learning to communicate effectively in writing and learning to read better was the difference between those two paths. And nothing in my view, and very little in my reporting, and I used to cover organized crime, very little in my reporting has been more dramatic to me.
Well, Terry, tell us about you. I mean, you teach autobiographical writing, right? So, these are people who know the story of their life. What's the value of putting it in, writing it out and putting it in print?
Well, that's just it. I don't think anybody really knows the story of his or her life until you've sat down and tried to get it into a story. The thing about stories, we don't really understand what a story is, why it works. All we know is it's one of the oldest and most widely used things that human beings do. If you watch a two-year-old being completely immersed in a story, you know there's something fundamental to being human going on there. I think one of the things that stories do, if you're approaching it rigorously, honestly, trying to get it right, it can actually enforce on you more rigor and more honesty, because if you don't know what's going on, if you're leaving parts out, if you're fudging the facts a little bit, it shows up in a story that doesn't hang together, doesn't make sense. And that's what the students in the writing workshop do for each other. They'll point out the places where you're not there yet. So writing is the instrument I use to understand what my stake in things is. And that's why it's important for medical students, because you have to be clear on what your own needs, wishes, motives are when you enter the clinical situation, where one of your primary responsibilities is to put those aside.
And so how does that – so they become more aware of themselves and how they work as they see themselves as part of a story. How does that help reduce or mitigate the pressures that you talked about, this putting distance between them and their patient, or them and their goals, because of their other pressures? How do they – I mean, does it make them more empathetic? Is that the point, or is that not it?
I don't know. I do think that it – if you can get your own stuff out of the way, you're more likely to be able to do something for the patient. And if that generates empathy, fine. But I think the most important thing is that the patient be helped. And this seems to me to be an extremely valuable tool to helping us do that.
Peg, you talked about these kids being in extreme situations where they're very likely to have a job, as you put it, where some part of them is going to hurt at the end of the day. Is this the ability to write and to think critically, does that allow them, you think, at some point to see themselves in a context? I didn't just fall in onto this Staten Island rock. I got here for a reason. There are forces that have, you know, sort of conspired to put me in this place. I mean, can they think more critically about their condition and how they got there?
I think they can think in a more complex way about everything in their lives, all the things that they were being taught. When they speak, after going through this writing program and understanding, being taught and practicing the mechanics of language, when they speak about themselves, when they speak about the world around them, they're much less general and they're much less inclined to speak in simple sentences, those simple text language kind of sentences that are just like active verb sentences. They actually used compound sentences, and they actually used complex ideas, and they actually used ideas that were contrasting within a sentence. And I have to think that teaching kids how to express themselves in that complex way, wherever you come from, contributes to an elevation of public discourse. And whether that's about who they are and how they got to Staten Island or who they're going to elect as president, I actually see that as a fundamental component and shoulder skill of our democracy. So I actually think that it's a little bit different than learning self-expression or self-awareness. It's how to engage in the world around them in an effective way.
What kind of changes do you see, Terry, in the students you work with?
Well, one of the first things I see, usually about the fourth or fifth week of the semester, is they start telling me they were working on the course far more than they intended to. What they tell me is that they feel that they have a better sense of why they're there. It's really easy to forget when you're up to your neck in biochemistry why you wanted to be a doctor in the first place. And they tell me this grounds them again. And I think that's pretty important. You don't want your doctor to be simply a technician. You want your doctor to understand you as a human being. And the first step to that is understanding yourself. If you can't do that, you're not getting any farther.
I think we're calling this narrative medicine. Is that right?
Yeah. I have a somewhat different take on it than Rita Sharon does. I'm more interested in writing. She's more interested in literature, although she certainly is interested in writing as well. But I came to this as a writer first, so of course I was – I mean, one reason why I'm so grateful to Rita is that she allowed me to make sense of myself as a doctor who writes, gave me a place in the profession, you might say. But, you know, listening to Peg, I think – there really is a lot. There are many points of connection between the kind of training she's talking about and the kind of thing that matters to me. I mean, she's absolutely right. Writing is the essential tool for developing habits of rigorous thought, of analysis, of, you know, the act of putting words down in sentences, assembling them in paragraphs, putting paragraphs together in an argument, because it objectifies your thoughts and you know, it kind of makes them physical. So you actually have to wrestle with them. That's vital to being able to understand your relationship to them and to get control over them to the extent that we ever can. It's the essential precondition to doing the higher level stuff that, you know, produces novels, helps people understand themselves, things like that. But you cannot get there unless you first mastered your instrument. You go to art school, you spend your first year learning, you know, how to handle your tools.
Yeah, how to gesso the canvas. Peg, had you thought about that? Why? Because if you think about it, just reading should build critical thinking skills. If I can decode this text, whether it's a piece of literature or a scientific document, that should make me a better analytical thinker. What is it about writing, about sort of feeding back the other way? Is it the mechanical act? Is it the parts of the brain that are engaged? Did you wonder why it was that writing made such a difference and why reading alone wasn't enough?
It was very interesting to me because, for me, it seems almost automatic, having grown up in a middle-class environment where my parents had a wide vocabulary and immersed me into this literature-soaked and vocabulary-soaked world. So for me, it was a little curious that children could – high school students could try and read the Gettysburg Address, and while they could decode every word, they couldn't make head or tail of it. And I knew that writing, from the research that I've read, that writing reinforces reading comprehension. I think that's the research base for that is pretty clear. But it was Monica DiBella, who I featured in my story, and she said something that really sent a shock down my spine. She personalized the research in this way. She has no idea of the research, let me just say, but she said to me, you know, I used to read, and it was just a sea of words. I never really knew what words were important. And then when I learned to write, and she was talking about putting together sentences and understanding parts of speech, then, she said, I knew what words were important. And I was able to comprehend, she went on to say, she was able to comprehend at a much deeper level. And it was really like being zapped with a cattle prod, because that's exactly what the research says. And there is a 15-year-old kid, not a worldly child in any way, who's expressing exactly what years and years of research tells us, that when you begin to write, when you go through the process of writing, you learn the parts of speech. You learn how to use standard English in a way that is at first simple, and then you grow in power, and then your skills grow in power. And that has a reinforcing effect for reading comprehension.
Terry, those kids in these schools and the program we're talking about were actually taught how to write. It's a technical skill. It's how to identify one part of speech from another and then quickly apply it in exercises. How do you teach writing? What is it that you're telling these med students?
Well, long ago I got a certificate to teach secondary school English, and I'm always grateful that I never had to use it because it's the hardest work on earth, and I don't know how well I could do it. I taught freshman composition and when I was in graduate school for a while, and that's how I learned how to write. But I'm dealing with students, as you say, who already have some sense of the mechanics good enough. I'm not correcting their grammar. They're good enough. The teaching of writing is on the level where I do it. It is an art as much as the writing itself. I simply try to encourage them and use my skills as a reader to show them what I think they've done.
And that's when it's important, getting back to something you said earlier, that you produce an artifact, an objectification of these thoughts that are swimming around your head. You now have something you can hold up, and that reflection probably is the best teacher. They read it and say, ooh, that didn't make sense.
Absolutely. And yet it's not all wrong. That's right. The thing. There is this resemblance. And building on that, you can start chipping away at the places that aren't quite right yet. And that's where this discipline of honesty comes into play.
So, Peg, what's your sense of how scalable what we learned at New Dorp is and what goes on at the Windward School, how scalable it is and whether or not it's something that can actually take hold?
Well, it would be really nice if everyone could just, you know, buy a curriculum and give it to their teachers on September 4th and have them teach it for the year, and everything would be better, right? Dropout rates would slow down and achievement rates would improve. And that's actually not how it would work. What happened at New Dorp was an interesting confluence of very strong leadership from the principal and also a process of inquiry where the teachers had to see for themselves what the kids didn't know, because they thought they were teaching under the assumption that the kids were lazy or stupid. And that was really at the bottom line. That's what they thought about the kids they taught. And they thought that all they could really do, all those kids could really handle, was rote instruction. So the teachers saw themselves as sort of the pit crew in the NASCAR race, you know, just get them in there, slap some new wheels on, and get them out to graduation, right? And through this process of inquiry, the teachers began to uncover, what do the kids really need to know? And so it was the teachers had were made to be sort of like the diagnosticians on House, you know, like looking at every test, every assignment as like a data point. What can we find out about the children and how do we fix this?
I hope
and
it's not.
So the teacher was,
go ahead.
The teachers were very, very active in understanding what the problem was. And then when they got a solution, they grabbed onto it.
I hope it's not like House because you got to be wrong three times before you can be right. No.
Plus,
kids only
plus
in school
MRI.
4 years. Yeah.
Plus it's always sarcoidosis or whatever that is.
I want to thank you both for being on the program today. Peg Tyer's article called The Writing Revolution in this month's issue of Atlantic. Her newest book is The Good School, How Smart Parents Get Their Kids the Education They Deserve. Thank you, Peg Tyer. Terrence Holt, clinical assistant professor in the Department of Geriatric Medicine and research assistant professor in the Department of Social Medicine at UNC Chapel Hill. His short story collection is called In the Valley of the Kinks. Terry, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things, a program you can find online at stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.